Hello and welcome to this week's edition of Underserved, the podcast for the rest of the tech industry. I'm your host, Andrew Jelina. With me in studio today is Gene Grella, Vice President of IT at Ethos Veterinary Health. Gene, welcome to the show.
Hi, Andrew. Thank you for having me. This is great.
Thank you for coming down, fellow Tesla owner.
Yep. I made it here safely.
So way back in the day, what got you interested in technology early on?
It was in high school, and I started high school in 1978, and we're all kind of thinking about where we're going to go, what are we going to do with the rest of our lives. I was in the math department because this is 1978, and we didn't have a computer lab, but they had three computers up there. They had these three Wang computers. Two of them had 4K of RAM. One of them had 8K of RAM. That was the one that everyone wanted to be on. And I noticed these guys playing a Battlestar Galactica game, and I was wondering how the heck they were doing that. I went to see them. I was like, what are you guys doing? And every once in a while, I'd see them break out of the game, and I'd see them coding and making changes to code and everything. And I'm like, wow, this is really awesome. So I started to learn to code right then and there. And when I noticed that it was dark outside before I was leaving school, that's when I realized, you know, I could do this the rest of my life. This is really cool. And I knew right then and there, I'm going into, well, IT, computer programming, whatever it was.
What language was the Battlestar game written in?
It was BASIC. And I went on to write other programs. It was the sort of thing where you'd have to constantly be loading parts of the program in because you had no memory from a cassette tape. So you'd have the cassette tape in there. We had a PDP-11 too, and that one didn't even have a monitor on it. It just had a printer. So everything would just print out.
Yeah, for those not from Massachusetts, both the Digital Equipment Corporation and Wang made a lot of donations to schools. They must have gotten a tax break or something. A lot of folks kind of cut their teeth on BASIC on those platforms. So you're writing these things, you get out to college, where do you go to school?
I went to Bryant College, grew up in Providence, and so I was local to Bryant. It was actually not a far drive for me. I really wanted computer programming. I wasn't thinking business at all. But at Bryant, it was all business. And it was business, and it was really IT. We called it MIS. It was an MIS program, Management Information Systems. But it was really IT. So we were programming, but it was COBOL. Somebody got administrative access into the system. It was a Data General 10,000, I believe, mainframe, but like a mini computer for the college, ran everything. And we had admin access to it. And so whenever we needed to, for instance, if you were writing a program and you wanted a printout of it, or you had to run the results of the program or report for your class, you usually had to wait in a print queue. The major abuse that I did with it was just constantly bump my stuff up to the top of the queue. So everybody was looking at me funny, like, why does he keep going back and forth to get his printouts when everybody else is here waiting for theirs? And yeah, nobody knew, but eventually the professors found out.
Well, if that's the worst thing you did, that's not too bad.
Yeah, we never hacked. I mean, we did have access to teachers' accounts and things like that and could have changed grades, and we never did anything like that.
Oh, so nothing like war games.
Nothing like war games, no. When they caught us, they kind of gave us a speech. I think that's where my hacking ended as far as doing anything unethical on a computer. I was like, yeah, this is too dangerous to ever do anything with this.
There's too much of a darn audit trail.
Yeah. But you feel cool when you're doing it. You know, back then it was the 80s and like, okay, I'm a nerd. I know how to do this stuff. And yeah, but then when you kind of get caught, it's like, I don't need any of this.
So you learned COBOL, the official language of business.
Yes.
Did that treat you well in your first job out of college, or did you not use it?
No, definitely used it. This is the 80s. I graduated in 1986. And during that time, it's the Reagan years. They're building up defense and all the defense contractors are hiring, which is great. You know, it's a good time to get started out there. I was happy they were hiring, and General Dynamics hired me right out of college. Matter of fact, I left my job making pizzas, okay, 3-4 nights a week, you know, and this is the summer. This is June because you're just out of college or whatever. In that heat, I went from that to professional office, and there was no time in between that I had off. I needed the money. So I went right into work. I'll never forget it. I got my professional job. You know, I'm wearing a suit to work every day, and I go into the office and I have my desk. I have a monitor. You know, we didn't have computers, but we had monitors, tape, scissors, paper. Oh my God, this is great. Look at all this stuff that they give me. I'm a professional now. And my boss, Steve, this is a great memory, whatever. He said, I'm going to take you out to lunch this week. We do this with all the employees. We take you out to lunch. So Steve takes me out to lunch, and Steve happens to belong with like three other families to a food co-op. So he's like, oh, I just got to stop my house because the delivery's coming to my house. And so the delivery comes to his house, and he's got all this stuff on the truck or whatever. he has me unload the truck for him. I got to take my coat off, my tie off. I'm like, wait a minute, this is my professional job. I'm back to doing menial labor. I'm sweating here. I'm like unloading this guy's truck for him. He, I don't think he told anybody that he had me do that, but he did take me out to lunch after I unloaded his truck.
So you got to go to lunch, but some assembly required.
Some assembly required. The little hoopers, they took you down a notch. It was like, yeah, you're not that far away from the guy who was making pizzas a week ago.
So at General Dynamics, I imagine as a defense contractor, they were kind of by the book, by the metric.
Oh my God, and great. Yeah. So they tracked everything and they kept a board up. And the one thing you never wanted to be, you never wanted to have a first run abend or any sort of abend, whatever. So for those of you who don't remember the COBOL program and mainframes, whatever, an abend is an abnormal end to your program. Basically, the thing craps out, some sort of memory leak or something like that, and it crashes. It crashes in production. And that's the last thing you wanted. A lot of these jobs, especially in a manufacturing environment, they run overnight. You had a whole schedule of jobs that would run. So you didn't want your job to crap out, because if your job crapped out, that meant that probably the schedule was going to stop at that point, and they were calling people up in the middle of the night. So they would track that. What they did is they used the same sort of metrics that they use, say, for the submarines. Quality control was extreme, and they used those same metrics to track everything to do with IT. So it was a great place. QA, everything you did had to go in front of a QA person. We had a QA team that would work with us. They do code reviews. It was great. So it was a great place to learn and you to kind of learn these habits that later on in your career, you wouldn't necessarily have that QA. Or maybe you're working at a small company and you're the only guy writing the code and you don't have a QA department, but you're disciplined enough to know what you have to do to QA it properly and test it properly. So it was great habits to get into. I think sometimes first job having a big company like that, it's good for people.
I completely agree. My first job out of college was at EDS, Ross EDS. Perot's old consulting company.
Yep.
And they had a procedure for everything. They had code reviews, they had style guides, they had coding standards, they definitely had the blueprint laid out for you that they wanted you to follow, you know, about how to write test drivers and how to do everything. And I think, like you said, it is good because you can see how everything is done, like how does version control work and how do I actually release something to production and how do I test it and make sure it's okay and respond to bug requests and yada, yada, yada. And then if you end up, like you said, somewhere else where you end up having to do all of this or you have to come up with a system, you've got one. You know, whereas if you just went to a startup right out of college,
exactly,
you're not going to get exposure to all these systems and processes that may serve you well later.
I think it would help too when people see EDS on your resume. They knew what kind of training you had. Everyone in the industry knew what type of training the EDS folks had to go through and how disciplined it was, which was a great experience.
I don't miss the part where if I got up out of my cube, I had to put my suit jacket on.
Did they smoke there? Because like when I was at General Dynamics, they were still smoking at your desk. People had ashtrays and people were still smoking.
So we were at a part of EDS that was grown by acquisition. They had bought a company that did cellular billing software in the Waltham area. So it was a little more lax than your super corporate Plano, Texas EDS, but still some formality to it.
Yeah. At General Dynamics, I went from submarines later on to tanks. So I got to go to the tank plant and I got to climb inside the M1A1 Abrams tank. That perspective, that company was kind of a cool company to be in with subs and tanks and their jets and all that.
What was the software doing for the tanks? Was it like provisioning?
What we did, it was logistics. So we were doing all the inventory and inventory control. Actually, I had to write for the land systems. I had to write this maintenance allocation chart, which was really a book, and had to construct a book of all the different parts and all the tools that you needed to basically do the assembly or whatever. So if you're changing out this part of the tank, you know, here's all the parts and tools that you need in order to get this done. And so the chart would take you through and explain all that. And it was like references and indexes and all of this. All my program had to do was kind of basically take all this data and assemble it into a book. When I first saw that what was needed in the program, it's like, this is what you want me to do. I had no clue on how to do this. I'm surprised because I was like a rookie. He was giving me this work to do. But my boss said, split it up into parts, break it up into parts. So, you know, that's what I did. I said, okay, I'm going to break it up into smaller programs and then reassemble it and actually stored the data so it could be written horizontally. It was stored in like vertical columns, but I had to take the pieces and take it out of the vertical columns and store it horizontally. It was the most complex thing I did because, you know, it's just like in word processing, right? If you get to the end of the little part of the chart that you have the section or column. And you get to the end, you got to put a hyphen or you got to refer to page 2 to 5. It's going to be either 2 to 5 or 2, 3. All the coding logic that you had to write for that was like writing a word processor in COBOL, which is the wordiest language, you know, so the programs were huge.
You reminded me when you said abend of the first time I was on Unix and I got a C program with a null pointer and it crashed, it's segmentation fault, core dump. I'm like, wait, what does that mean?
Where's my abend aid? Whatever. It used to be a program that would help you read your abends that you could figure out where the memory issue was.
Yeah, we've still got some of that today.
Yeah, we do. Certainly, yes, they haven't gotten rid of memory leaks.
So you leave General Dynamics. Where do you go after that?
After General Dynamics, I went to, which was at the time, Denison Manufacturing over in Framingham, Massachusetts. Turned out to be Avery Denison as the companies merged. The person who was the department secretary, I ended up marrying. So that was a very good stop in my career. It was just a great place to work. I really learned hardcore manufacturing there. I got to work on some awesome special projects, one where we went after inventory. So when Avery came in, they had kind of this troubleshooter that they would bring in. And that troubleshooter, they assigned me to him. And what we did is we took a look at the inventory at the warehouse level and we did the forecasting. So I got to write these programs that basically download data from the manufacturing system and inventory. It would run into this PC program that load back up. And I have all these scripts that were like downloading data, loading data and everything. But at the end of the day, we were able to report back to the company that we saved millions in inventory. And so from that perspective, you get the feeling like, okay, I'm really contributing here. I'm contributing to the bottom line of this company. And it made you feel really good.
Yeah, when you can see like either lowered cost or raised revenue and that moved the needle, it's definitely gratifying.
Yeah, I have a story about that too. So there was a point when I was at Avery Denison where one of our largest parts of the company, largest division, it broke off and got their own IT. So rather than a shared IT service, they got their own IT and they were kind of poaching from the central group. And they poached me and I got a raise. That was really what I was looking for. It's like, I'm staying in the same company, but they're going to give me more money. This is great. And we had been going through this whole merger acquisition and then we were on a wage freeze for a while. So I got into the new job and everything. And then I think it was Chuck Miller was the guy who was the CEO of Avery. He notifies all of Avery that we're going to be freezing wages for the next year. So I go to my boss. I'm like, does this mean me? Because I'm new. You guys said I got this raise or whatever. It's like, yeah. You're captain. You're not getting a raise. I'm like, I can't believe this. I'm going to go 2 years without a raise. I was like, so I sat down and I wrote a letter to Chuck Miller and looked up where his address was. And, you know, this is old school. It's not email. I just wrote the letter, you know, printed it out, mailed it to him and just forgot about it. And a month or so later, I get this letter back and it's from Chuck Miller. And he writes me and he's like, I read your letter to the board of directors. And we're going to end the wage freeze. I went to my management and I showed him this letter and they looked at him like, what the hell are you doing? Why didn't you tell us you did this? I didn't tell anybody that I did it. I was like, you know, I figure you do something like that. Maybe something good will happen. Maybe nothing will happen. Maybe they'll fire me, you know, for speaking out or whatever. But I still have that letter. And it was the most amazing thing. I thought, you know, most things for a CEO to address me directly and especially at a company that size and say, you know what? We realized that this harms people. We're going to end the wage freeze. And I got to tell my bosses before they ever knew about it.
You should be a folk hero there. They should be taking you out to lunch every day without having to unpack a vegetable truck first.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow. So a few years later, you end up working at Tom Siebel's company, right?
Yes. Yeah, we went through that whole dot-com crash. And I found myself right before things got really bad in the IT industry. I found myself out of work. First time I had ever been out of work. And I was searching. And I love to program. I was a coder. And I love to develop software. But I said to myself, all these smaller companies that I've been going to and startups or whatever, they're not really making it. I got to go with a company that I know is going to be stable. I had a young family. 3 kids with one on the way, actually. Actually, I had 4 kids at the time. It's all little. And I was like, yeah, I got to have a stable job. So when I saw Siebel and Siebel had a job for me, now they didn't have the exact job that I wanted. They had a job in customer support, but what the team was supporting was they were supporting the developers who do all the customization, you know, Siebel. So when you buy Siebel, you want it to customize it. We have our own coding language, et cetera. And so my team would end up doing that support. So it was development support. But for the next 7 years, I was customer support. I led that configuration team, later went on to run the Burlington Support Center there. And yeah, I was there for like 7 years doing support.
Was this when you guys were part of Oracle?
This is before Oracle. This is when we were on our own. Had some interesting times with customers. The one that I remember the most was that we used to all get support account manager jobs. In other words, we'd have to manage our teams. I had a team of 25. We did reviews every quarter too, which was crazy. But we also got assigned to specific accounts. And so I had my accounts like everybody else. We had a new account coming up, and Tina, one of my fellow managers, she was assigned to that account. But my boss finds out that Tina is pregnant. And she knew something that I didn't know going into it, that this account was not going well. And so she's like, look, I can't really assign this to Tina. It might be too much stress for her. I'm going to send you in there instead. And they send me in to meet with all talent, like the CIO, vice presidents, everybody in the room, this major telecommunications company. And they're just telling us how horrible we are. And I'm trying to put my best customer service face on, but they just hammered me. And I spent the next like 6 months just working to make these guys happy. And eventually we got there. They were very happy and we got to be in a very good state. But that first call, and I can understand now why they didn't want Tina to do it, because I was just totally under fire. Customers beat the hell out of you, you know? So I took that experience. You know what I use that for? I use that to now beat the hell out of my vendors when they don't do the right thing. I learned from it. This is what you do to get your vendors in line.
And the cycle continues.
And the cycle continues.
So what did you notice about, you know, with Tom Siebel at the helm versus a Larry Ellison? How was it different?
There wasn't a lot of difference. I think Tom was a little bit nicer than Larry. Tom had built a newer company and he didn't have a lot of acquisitions. And so Tom was very rigid about, especially within IT, of like what you could do. And everything ran through Siebel or PeopleSoft. That was it. There was nobody sneaking in with, oh, I get this third party program that is great. I got this extra thing that you could bring into IT. It's like, no, we'll modify the platform in order to support whatever your business need is. There was one company I remember where you went to the intranet, everything was there. You knew exactly where to go. It was single sign-on throughout. You signed in once. And they had created this really rigid but good system, at least within IT. So you had all your tools and everything. We eventually got the analytics product. I think it was Siebel Analytics. That's right. We had purchased another company, Siebel Analytics, that later became Oracle BI. And that product was amazing because that allowed us now to see our data in different ways and really look at our customer data and understand it. So we used it internally. It ended up becoming a great product that Oracle eventually would sell. But when we came in with Larry, they both had a very strong control over the companies. Tom Siebel, definitely top-down control. He would attend. We would do those, you know, those customer meetings. We were Sam's and we all had accounts or whatever. He would hold twice a week these reviews of red accounts, red account reviews. And he was very, very customer focused, which I think made Siebel successful. He would have the red count reviews and we'd all be on there. We'd all have to speak to our accounts and what was going on in the account. He wanted to know. And he actually kind of one of the people who taught me that the way you treat your customers and the customer service piece is going to help in sales down the road, or it's going to benefit you in the sales side. So it's important to keep that customer close and happy. So I was really surprised that he'd always be on those red account calls. Larry Ellison, the budgetary control was a thing that shocked me. So later on, when I went to work for Oracle, I made the switch back from customer service into IT, and I was actually heading up IT operations for the support team. And when we need to buy servers, first of all, he had worked a contract with Michael Dell. So, and Dell was actually across the street from our data center. So everything had to be Dell, had to go through Dell on a specific server. So if you had to buy anything, all my purchase orders had to go up to Larry Ellison to get approved, just so he could make sure that nobody was skirting around the contract that he had done and buying something different than what he had prescribed for us.
That's why he's worth $106 billion today.
Yep.
Hey, sport. How was school today?
It was okay, Dad. How was work?
Ugh, actually, I had a rough day. Leading an engineering team is hard. I mean, I have to ship new software, meet deadlines, and tackle new projects while keeping my team focused on the day-to-day. It's hard to keep up.
Jeepers, Dad. I Why you call Cerence? They are the software engineering firm run by software developers. They helped Billy's dad. He used to be stressed out like you. He was missing deadlines, his team was overworked, and a bunch of folks left the company because it was too stressful. But then he called Cerence. And they put developers to work right away. He hit all his deadlines and freed up his team to do other work. His boss was so happy Billy's dad got some extra time off.
Time off? Wow. What did he do with that?
He spent it with Billy.
Aww. That's a swell idea, son. I'll call Cerence today. Now, you go wash up for supper.
So after that, you end up leveraging some of these Oracle skills at Genzyme?
Yeah, so Genzyme was looking for someone to run their new production instance of Oracle EBS. And so I had the production support background. The foundation for Oracle EBS was the same foundation that we were using in our system. So it was easy for me to take on that. And actually, the way I kind of hooked up with that job is those were all the guys who were over with me at Avery Dennison, a lot of them anyway. And the CIO there, he was the, at the time, he was the head of applications development for Avery Dennison. So I went to work for him as the CIO, Robert Cowie, really nice guy. And it's kind of like the old gang got back together. Unfortunately, it was short-lived, because Genzyme ended up selling out to a big French pharmaceutical company, Sanofi. And so I went to work for Sanofi, and that was an experience. Not by choice. I don't have anything bad about Sanofi, but where they were at that time, where they were trying to bring in their whole infrastructure team, and I was part of their infrastructure team, they had really done this creation of an organization by committee. And what they had done was created all these jobs. They created an org chart. They had the team kind of create the org chart. It didn't make a lot of sense. You know, the first thing you know, when you look at an org chart and someone has to like sit down and explain it to you all the time, that's a bad org chart. Org charts should just on paper should just look right and make sense. And this one, we're like, what does that group do? What does that group do? And once they created all the org structure, they opened up these jobs and they opened up to anybody. So the guy who ended up getting the job as, like, for instance, head of the DBAs, and he had a team about, I think he had a team about 30 some odd people, had never managed before. But he was the guy who applied, and nobody else applied for that job. So it was bizarre. And this is, it was the most bizarre organization. Now, after I left, I had heard that they dismantled it all and they kind of rebuilt it again. But it was a crazy time there. The one thing I remember and the best thing about working for Sanofi was the trips to France. And all the teams would just fly you there. That and the fact that most of the company took all of August off. So that was good too.
Sounds very French.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't get it off, but at least your bosses weren't on you, like at least in the month of August. Things kind of chilled out during August.
All right. From there, did you go to a 5-star quality care?
Yeah. So 5-star quality care, I was there for 6 years. 5-star, it was a large corporation in the sense that it's over $1 billion in revenue. They had somewhere around 17,000 employees, 286 senior living facilities. And what I learned over time was that each one of these senior living facilities operates on its own, and that 5-star really kind of was like a smaller company, at least the corporate entity piece of it. You know, it kind of ran like a smaller company, and it was a very family-oriented company, and the IT challenges there were many, you know, as we were moving from basically a hub-and-spoke network of MPLS 1.5 meg. I mean, try to do anything with 1.5 meg. You know, that's a network I kind of stepped into, and it's like, yeah, we need to change this. And so we started this whole network improvement project, just bringing in broadband circuits and changing everything over. Yeah, there was a lot to be done. And we got to do electronic health records, which they were just completely paper-based. So I got to experience kind of building out the infrastructure for the electronic health records at that company, which is Wi-Fi, access points, all the desktops, laptops. Got my first experience with Google Chrome there, which I'm now using it at Ethos as well, which I found to be just a phenomenal platform, especially for electronic health records. Not to give Google a plug here, but I got to tell the truth. It really saved us a lot of money because we had everything slated as laptops, $1,400 Dell laptops, and we were able to swap them out and replace them with Chromebooks that were going for $300,
$400. Oh, nice. My kids' schools definitely squeeze the most out of those Chromebooks.
You do. You know, it's such a great model because if a Chromebook breaks and there's a user using it, I mean, they have nothing tied to that. You can go on the shelf, get them on the Chromebook, they're back up and they're working. Even if they have their own environment, it's all in the cloud. So everything just comes back. Whereas we'd have to go and it's a PC, rebuild the PC, copy their data over. In some cases, they lose data. You know, you have to worry about operating systems, virus scanning, SCCM, all this stuff that you didn't have to worry about with the Google platform.
So essentially, we're back to the mainframe.
Exactly. My career's gone full circle. But, you know, the centralized system versus decentralized.
Now, are the folks in the care homes like Zooming with their relatives, or what's chewing up the bandwidth there?
Yeah, that was something that we had to move very quickly during COVID. They found themselves isolated. All of our senior living communities, the people were isolated, and we needed to get them something so that they could do those calls with it. And I happened to be in the process of just negotiating a deal with Zoom at the time. And my rep said to me, he's like, hey, could you guys use a few hundred licenses? At least, you know, we'd give them to you. But companies were willing to do stuff during COVID, you know, not completely charitable, but, you know, I mean, they knew that there was business down the line probably there if they got us kind of hooked on it, but it was nice of them. And I immediately said, this is great. I think we took like 350 licenses, and I just started distributing around the senior living communities so that we bought 150 iPads, we distributed those, we got them out to the senior living communities so that the directors there, they could go around and meet with people and say, hey, we're going to do a Zoom with your family. And they would set up calls and people could see their families. Otherwise, they were isolated. They were looking out the window at folks, but they couldn't meet with their family members anymore. And it was a really trying time. So that was a case where technology really helped. And we ended up at Five Star working closely with Zoom. We ended up using it for our meetings, for large corporate meetings. That's another thing too, is all the corporate meetings that we had to do, all hands meetings, things like that, which we needed to do frequently. We needed a platform to do that, and Zoom was a great platform for that.
So you move from helping out two-legged patients to four-legged patients?
Yes, this is my latest venture, is working with four-legged friends in the veterinary industry.
And what does your company do, and how do you fit in there?
So Ethos Veterinary Health is a hospital provider, so they provide advanced medical care. So, you know, you take your vet wellness visits, things like that. You don't typically take it to Ethos for that. It's when, say, you need treatment for your animal. In advance, we do therapy for cancer, so we have oncology. We do all types of surgeries, so we have operating rooms. It's basically a kind of full-service hospitals for animals, mostly cats and dogs. And what do I do for them? This is kind of back to startup again. I'm taking in working to transform the IT operations aspects of this. We have a team distributed around their individual hospitals, a lot of separate local managed service providing care. And we kind of bring it all in to centralize it. And I teach an architecture class at Clark University, enterprise architecture. And we go through the stages of IT architecture. And stage two is really the standardization phase. And it's the one where you get the biggest bang for the buck. And it, you look at, okay, we're going to standardize on our platforms, we're going to standardize on our vendors. And you'll obviously save a lot of money on doing that. And that's exactly what we're doing here. You know, we're standardizing on our vendors. We're basically getting on the same Palo Alto firewalls. We're standardizing on our phone systems. We are standardizing on the service providers that we're using so that we're not all over the place. And we're seeing the benefits of it.
So tell me a little bit more about teaching at Clark. What got you into it? And what other things are you trying to impart to the next generation?
So I realized I have all these stories to tell, you know? And when you start telling the people that work and they're kind of, okay, I've heard this before, whatever. And it's like, I really need an outlet for taking this knowledge and all this experience and time that I've spent and really sharing with young people, because a lot of times you can read things in books, but it's really not how it goes, you know? And so, you know, I put my name out there. I met with the dean, assistant dean over at the School of Professional Studies at Clark University, and he told me about this class that he had, the first class, not the architecture class, which was an IT leadership class. And he said, but the downside is I don't have the previous professors left. I don't have any of his materials or anything like that. You're going to have to build this from scratch.
Not a downside.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I agree because it's much easier to teach what you put together versus what somebody else. From my perspective, I was thinking coming into it that they were going to maybe give me a book, give me a syllabus, and, you know, and then I was going to be able to kind of create within that. But I had to invent this IT leadership class. And I took a book. It's called The Adventures of an IT Leader. It was done by Harvard Business, and the authors tried to create a story around really a business professional. He's head of one of the business organizations, and he becomes the CIO. CIO gets fired. The CEO, who's like basically trying to transform this company, he puts this guy who has no IT experience other than complaining to IT. That's his experience. And now he owns it. And the reason he owns it is because he's the biggest critic of IT. So he's like, yeah, you know what? You always had good ideas about that, the CEO tells him. So we're going to put you in charge of this. And so you go through the journey as he learns IT at a high level from the people who work for him, you know, and he can't understand, for example, why it is that when we're trying to make a decision, we need expertise in the room. And his managers have to tell him, it's like, well, you know, we don't really know this stuff anymore. I started programming COBOL, okay? My guys program Java now. You know, I don't know what they know in Java. So if you're telling me how long is this going to take to complete or whatever, I need these people in the room. And it's that sort of thing. So what it allowed me to do, this book and putting the curriculum together around that subject, and that was to bring in all this real world experience that I had. So we talk about security and we talk about a security incident. Well, I've been through, unfortunately, a few security incidents.
Been there, done that.
Know? Sort of like a disaster, you know, and you're all on that call and you're trying to figure out what's going on and you're trying to figure out what you're going to do next. Like, yeah, I can tell you what it's really like in the real world when that happens. And, you know, A, we want to be prepared for it, but B, you can't prepare for everything. You need to kind of take control. And so we go through that. So that's really why I wanted to teach it, and actually it's been very fulfilling.
Now, you also got involved with, I think it was it your wife's friend who was into the Revolutionary War reenactment stuff?
Yeah, my wife's best friend, she married a guy, and this guy had been doing Revolutionary War acting. He's a very close friend of mine now. Joe, and he'd been doing Revolutionary War reenacting since he was 15 years old. He started during the bicentennial, and he's like, hey, do you want to get into this? And I'm like, you know what? I love history. Yeah, I'll try it. I'm game for anything. So I got into it and actually liked it. It was amazing. I started in the year 2000, and so that happens to be the 225th anniversary of everything. That starts off the calendar because, you know, the revolution started in 1775, right? So the 225th started in 2000, and then every year after that, there'd be another 225th as we hit another event, right up until the end of the war, right up to the end of Yorktown. I was there for Yorktown, the 225th of Yorktown, 8 years later. So it was amazing. And that kind of morphed into also what I do today, which is the Patriots End Zone Militia.
What is the End Zone Militia?
So the New England Patriots End Zone Militia, it's a name that was coined by Matt Light, who is an offensive lineman for the Patriots. And that's what he called us. And so we call ourselves that. We are the guys who stand in the end zone. And when the Patriots score, we fire off the muskets.
Quite loud and yes, thunderous. I have been very close. I want to say Section 225 or something when those have been going off. And yeah, it's quite something.
Yeah. And it's so much fun. And I have to say, it's fun to be at the games and everything, but how much fun is it to be on the field and a punt is coming towards you, you know, and you got to hold a musket, but you want to put out your hand and catch it.
Did you guys start with the Revs or with the Patriots?
So, matter of fact, one of the guys in my group with the 9th Mass of Braintree, he contacted the Kraft family around doing the Revolution games because they had just started up the team. And he's like, hey, we'll do this for you. And it was all volunteer work. It was nothing that we got paid for. And actually, I wasn't even doing it at the time, but a bunch of guys would do it. Our guys and maybe 4, 5, 6 people. And a few years after them doing it for the Revolution, they said, oh, we want to bring you into the Patriots game. And it really culminated at that Super Bowl season. We had, as a great Sports Illustrated picture of our guys standing during that Oakland game in the snow. You know, it looks like Valley Forge. They have their hats on. It's covered in snow with blankets on it. And you can find this out. You know, it's out on the internet. But it's a great shot of the Minutemen hunkering down like Valley Forge during that game. The year later after that, and that's when I joined, they said, oh, we're at the new stadium. We want to expand this out. And we want to get it to 20 guys. Can you bring 20 to the game? And so I joined at that point. I think the first years it was the drop kick. I was in the end zone for the drop kick. Right in that end zone, right behind, watch the ball go overhead.
Wow. Have you ever high-fived any players?
Yes. Oh, there used to be a tradition where the tight ends would have to high-five us. That was like the start of the game. I think it was started by Christian Fourier, started it, and Ben Watson continued it, and it continued right on to Gronk. It actually kind of lost it when we lost Gronk. Somewhere along the line, it didn't make the translation, but I was so excited. Every game, we'd be out there on the sideline, and Gronk would come out, and he'd run over to us, and he'd high-five all of us, and Gronk's just a great guy. I've high-fived Tom Brady a few times. It's one of those things where, like, you didn't wash your hand for days. You touched the goat.
So you got this huge musket. How do you load it to fire it? What's the procedure?
So we make all of our own kit and everything. So we keep a cartridge box and we have, in my case, 23 shots in there that we use a very lightweight construction paper and we roll it into cylinders. We fill it up with gunpowder We say 100 grains, but it's really a lot more, especially at those Patriots games. So I don't know how to convert 100 grains into ounces or whatever, but enough to make a good boom, you know. So what we do is it's kind of a two-part procedure. You have a flint and it's going to strike a pan. It's going to make a spark, and that's what's going to eventually light the musket. So we do something called prime and load, where we prime, we put a little gunpowder in a pan at the lock and then close something called the frizzen. And then we put the gunpowder down the barrel. At that point, you'd put the paper and you'd ram. We don't ram because ram is not safe. And people have been known during reenactments to leave the ramrod in the musket and then fire the ramrod off. When things got crazy in reenactments, oh, you don't want that happening at a Patriots game. The worst thing a person did at a Patriots game is I think they left like either a rag or what we call a tampon, something that we use to, if it's raining out, we put like this little clothespin like thing into the end of the barrel to keep the rain from going in. And someone fired one of those off during a Patriots game. So that's the worst. We try not to do any procedures where you're putting anything other than the gunpowder down the barrel.
That's pretty awesome. How many home games do you think you've been to doing this?
It's got to be in the hundreds of home games. I usually do, if I miss one or two a season, and that's only due to rotation. Last year, I was there for all of the games. You may not notice because they never put us on TV. We were on TV for the first game of the season and then the last game of the season. That's the only time the fans ever saw us. But we were there. There were five of us that were there with our masks on, with Pat Patriot and about 10 cheerleaders up on the bridge next to the lighthouse every game.
Didn't Cam Newton call you guys out?
He did. Yes, Cam Newton. He said, these are my guys, you know, and he tried to throw a football to us. That was like the highlight of our season because he had scored a touchdown. He kind of ran up and tried to throw a football up. And I think he could make it like distance if it was just straight, if he didn't have to fight gravity to throw it up to the bridge. But yeah, he wasn't making it up. But in his press conference, he did call us out afterwards.
That's cool. So one of your other hobbies, one that we share, is you like to make things fly, like drones and planes. How'd you get into that?
Something that I've wanted to do since I was a kid. I was flying and never had the time or the money because it was always a very expensive hobby. And I think the hobby came down in price. I got into better shape financially. You know, you get older and your kids move out of the house. So you could start spending money on some of these things. But yeah, the prices on planes has changed. I used to fly those, I don't know if you ever did, those line planes, those Cox line planes.
Control line.
The control line, exactly. People still do that too. It's still a big hobby and they fly much bigger planes and for longer time and do all kinds of tricks with them. But I used to fly my control line, but you know, I flew it for maybe like a week or two or whatever until you crashed it.
Inevitably.
And then, yeah, you had to wait to get another one because your parents weren't going out and buy another one. What happened to the other plane? Yeah, I crashed it. Okay, you're done. So it was done at that point. And by the way, the hobby hasn't changed that much from that perspective. You still crash them.
And wait for mail order.
And get parts or you just end up trashing the plane. But so I always wanted to do it. And then I found out that they had like a field that was nearby. It's like 5 minutes away from my house. I found that field. It's like, oh, okay, I'm going to do that. And I kind of went out and met the guys and joined the club. And it's been great ever since. And used computers too, because part of the way I learned to fly, not crash, is computer through computer simulation. So I ride real flight on my computer and I could, before I ever took a plane out, I just practiced taking off, landing, you know, and did all my crashing on the computer screen. So actually when I finally got a plane out, I didn't crash it at all.
Now, how big are these RC planes? Are they electric? Are they gas?
I fly mostly electric. They do it in millimeters, like a typical size is like 1700 millimeters. It's the wingspan or whatever. It's hard to describe, but good size plane.
Like 6 feet?
Yeah. Wingspan roughly around anywhere from, I'd say like 4 to 6, around that size. Most of them are electric now because the technology is amazing with a lithium battery. So you can get these big 6L lithium batteries. We have jets. I like the planes, the Warbirds. I have a nice P-38, twin engine P-38. That's a real fun to fly and looks beautiful in the air.
I always thought the RC thing was the coolest. When I was little, my dad got a control line plane. We built it together, brought it out. It was so hard to control. I mean, it was like you did something wrong and boom, the thing was instantly in the ground. It was gas powered. You had to use a piece of hose called a chicken stick to like beat the propeller to get it to start running. It was a great way to get injured or have something go wrong.
We have a lot of guys, if they fly nitro planes or actual gas planes too. The gas engines run slower. Some of them are like, got like a 4-stroke engine. They run these nitro planes and a lot of guys still do that. A lot of times they'll have the electric starter to get it started. But I love watching those guys and I still love watching those planes. I'm not ready to dive into that yet because of just the fuel and all the mess associated with it. The electrics are just so easy. You just get out there and just fly.
I hear you. So you also got into drones as well and doing the FPV thing. What have you done with that?
Yeah, so I haven't raced. I do, I guess, what's called freestyle, which is just take the thing out and fly it around a field, or I've flown it around my neighborhood too. You put the goggles on and it's like you're driving the drone yourself, and you get in there and you just fly that thing around. It's amazing what you see, and it's amazing how fast you go, but you can't see it. People tell you, you know, you're just zipping around the field. I've done that with planes too. Actually, I've FPV flew a plane, which got so much easier to fly when you're actually on the plane versus you're trying to fly it as a third person. I had a plane where I was doing a loop and actually the prop broke on the plane. So I just had to glide it into the runway, and it was actually no problem to glide it in FPV, you know, where you kind of struggle doing that, doing it from a third party perspective.
I imagine it was just like playing that flight simulator game.
That's right. Well, you know, but you're in the cockpit. It's great. You see the nose of the plane and you see the field, and you could just, it's so much easier to fly it that way. And these drones go so fast. It's amazing. And we even have the, which I brought today, the smaller drone. It's a Hawk. I have the Hawk 5 and I have the baby Hawk, which is just a little tiny drone with a camera on it. It's amazing.
So Gene, thank you very much for coming down and appearing on Underserved and sharing your stories with our listeners.
Well, thank you, Andrew, for having me. This has been a blast.
And we'll talk to everyone soon on the next episode of Underserved.